I want to start off by giving it kind of framing. So the class that I had like a lot of fun co-teaching this past semester here at Yale was called Maimonides and Postmodernism. I taught it with Marcy Shore, who teaches European intellectual history since Nietzsche. And the idea for the class that came together over a couple of years, actually met our kids, because our kids went to Hebrew school together before the pandemic. It's how all great Jewish intellectual collaboration started. The thing that was really striking was the way, and that made the class worth pursuing, I think, was that Maimonides and postmodernism grow out of the same intuition, which is of being very steeped in, very shaped by, very devoted to a tradition that has one believes to be inadequate to the moment, broken, and in some sense part of the problem. Right. Imagine you were, say, a student of Martin Heidegger's, but also you read a lot of Marxism, and that was really informative to you. And then it turns out after the war, not only was Heidegger a Nazi, you knew that, but he didn't, you know, try to save his spouse, his students' Jewish spouses. And then perhaps most unforgivable, I mean, people have different things they have trouble forgiving, but for some of them, it was when Heidegger republished some of his works that he had published initially under the Nazi regime, which included pro-Nazi footnotes. Heidegger, in 1951, he republished a new edition, and he changed many of the footnotes and left in a lot of the pro-Nazi ones. Like, what are you to do, right? Your teacher, the greatest representative of the European philosophical tradition, probably since Immanuel Kant, has turned out to be literally an unrepentant Nazi. And then, you know, a few years later, you start to find out that the realization, the place that makes the Marxist values you are reared on most real in the world, the Soviet Union, is actually a repressive, horrific violator of human rights and the enemy of everything you thought that, you know, human dignity stood for. What are you to do, right? When you're the main earthly instances and interpreters and authorities of the traditions that you love have been shown to be inadequate to the moment, and in some ways, you know, even perhaps part of the problem, God forbid. And that is part of the crisis that births postmodernism. Our traditions are in crisis. Do you love the artist or the man? Yeah. I mean, what do you do when you love them both and also hate what they've been part of? I think that's the... and so that is what I want to suggest. That is what we're going to see today is Maimonides as someone who is in a tradition that he believes is in crisis and doesn't leave. So, you know, one thing you could do as a postmodern philosopher, as a philosopher, is say, well, all these ideas, what we learned is that ideas are dumb. There's a lot of Marxist theory. Heidegger wrote a lot. That didn't do anything. I'm going to go do something else, you know, because the world's going to be saved by something else, or maybe it's not going to be saved, but I might as well do something else that doesn't even have the pretensions of saving it. So that's one route you could just leave everything. But, you know, if you don't do that, you have to strike out in a new direction. And that is exactly what we're going to do today. So this framing is, in some ways, today is like an opposite of last week. And what I mean by that is last week, we really think Maimonides, we're doing his, what you might call his anthropology, not in the sense of the academic study of anthropology, but his theory of what a human being is. Right? There was nothing distinctively Jewish. We weren't really working on Torah verses. He was describing a picture of what it means to be a human being who strives, who believes in some kind of potential, who works very hard, who therefore steps outside of, you know, what people kind of conventionally do and embrace. And that was his picture of what it means to be a human. That makes sense. Now we're going to do something very different, which is his account of what it means to live in the Jewish tradition at the moment when he's living it, as the kind of person that he's living it, in the type of perplexity that we had from the first session. But it's entirely conditioned on being part of a tradition, if that makes sense. The types of problems he's having, and therefore the types of solutions he's coming to, would never happen to a person who wasn't steeped in and loved and in some ways hated their tradition. Does that make sense? So do it. And I just want to point out, you know, these are the types of questions you might want to be bouncing around in your own head for the kind of neo-Maimonidean applications here. It could include things like, well, what does it mean to live under an American constitution, which was a compromise with slavery? You know, what does it mean to be part of an American political tradition where it seems like, you know, there's a strong patriarchal thread, which has been revived by the Dobbs, the Alito decision, and Dobbs, right? You know, what do you do with these, or a Canadian one? Thank you. I'm always so U.S.-centric. In Canada, they right, ruled that the Constitution protects abortion. You're in better shape on that one. But what does it mean to kind of live in a tradition that you believe is not only kind of not addressing all the problems, but is actually sometimes on the wrong side of them and is making them worse? That's the kind of general question. We all have that in our minds if we poke hard enough and are honest enough. So I just want to frame, sorry, one more second. And if you could just turn off the screen share for 1 second, I want to just frame a little bit of what we're doing. The pastoral genre, not like pastoral care, like the genre of like writing plays about shepherds, right, is often useful because you can depict, portray certain styles of relationships, conflict, power, et cetera, among shepherds. But if you said, this is how the king relates to people, you would have gotten beheaded, right? Or people wouldn't have heard you. They would have just thought you were, you know, speaking in a political echo chamber or whatever. But if you portray the art, you know, you can edit, kind of remove, see things that you wouldn't see up close. So the analog here is that the issue that Maimonides thinks human life kind of rises and falls on the value of human life is our capacity to know that God doesn't have a body. Not the equality of all human beings irrespective of sex, not like, you know, undoing structures of oppression, not, you know, the progress of democracy, not any of those things we care about. And so what's helpful about Maimonides is you can see someone fighting tooth and nail about something we're not even capable of getting in fights about, right? Like if you like asked me to get in a fight with someone so I might lose a relationship about whether God has a body, I wouldn't be capable of it. I just don't care about it enough to, you know, lose friends over it. Does that make sense? So it's helped, but Maimonides did. And we have other things we care enough about to maybe lose friends over. And so what's helpful is we're going to watch Maimonides go through the same kinds of moves we do, but in a field that's kind of conflict-free so we can observe it from the outside. Conflict-free for us, if that makes sense, or uncharged. The last thing I want to say before we jump in is to situate where we are in the guide. We're in the kind of middle of the arc of section one. What I mean by that, section one is where Maimonides develops what is normally misnomered as his negative theology. I hope we will get have a session later after these next three interpretive sessions towards the end about claims Maimonides doesn't actually believe in negative theology, but let's call it negative theology for a moment. So the kind of the positive theology is one posits certain traits of God. God is loving. God is gracious. God is compassionate. Maybe God is also jealous. God is powerful. And that these statements have some truth to them. Right? They describe God in the way that our statements about my table is solid, you know, this person is fast, describe those people. And Maimonides is very against that for a whole host of reasons, but actually relate to his dislike of the human body, doesn't like the divine body anymore. So his critique of that kind of thinking is an ascending ladder. It begins with a critique of anthropomorphism, the idea that God has a body. Bodies imply limitations. It then ascends, and that's, you know, the early chapters of the guide, including the very first one. It ascends then to a critique of anthropopathism, that God has emotions, which I'm always concerned are intrinsically reactive and display a lack of power and are not to be attributed to God. As an aside, the phrase that God is not the unmoved mover, but the most moved mover is actually not due to Heschel, but his student, Fritz Rothschild, and his editor. You know, that kind of anti-Maimonidean move of the 20th century. And it's at that the conclusion of that section that Maimonides offers the thoughts that we're about to see. Now, there is a further section, which I just want to address. We're not going to look at it really in this course, although it's totally fascinating, which for a long time was read as a critique of the capacity of human language to describe God, right? That any linguistic utterance would intrinsically fall short just by the limited nature of human language. And this is related to the linguistic turn in 20th century European philosophy, really a focus on language as a, you know, not just a transparent medium for communicating the world, but something that is an entity unto itself. And this turns out not to be the right or the fullest reading of Maimonides, but the best reading, although it does have something to it, the fuller reading of Maimonides, the better reading of where he actually culminates, is not a critique of human language, but the human capacity for thought. Because in his concluding sections, and again, Stern lays this out with exceptional clarity, although it's not easy to get through, what Maimonides lays out is that human thought on his conception of thinking is built on the subject-predicate distinction. There are objects, properties, attributes of God is one. And for Maimonides, even the subject-predicate distinction, there's between a noun and an adjective, which he thinks are not just features of language, but features of human thought, which we can't get outside of, implies a duality. because there's a distinction between what is and what is known about it. Right? I am Jason means that there's a me and there's a name which are distinct in some way, conceptually. And that's not, again, because of language. It's actually because of how we human cognition operates. And therefore, since God is irreducibly singular, right, does not admit of any internal division, human thought is incapable of describing God or attaching to God in any way, because human thought is intrinsically built on objects and their properties, which have distinctions. So that's very interesting, because it goes back a little bit to what we were saying last time, that, you know, Maimonides seems to be saying on a first reading, body bad, thinking good. But then we saw he also doesn't like lazy thinking, right? That's just the same as bodily stuff. You just take your first intuitions that come to mind, take a little break from eating, drinking, and copulating to read a book and have some thoughts about it. That's not really thinking. Thinking is part of an economy of pleasure, and if it's strenuous, it's good. But thinking itself falls short, ultimately, for Maimonides. There is no such thing as, there is something beyond what can be thought, which is really interesting, right? Does that make him a rationalist? Does that make him not irrational? So we're not going to quite get there in Maimonides. So the critique that we see falls before that. But I just want you to know that that's kind of where he heads ultimately. And this is critical just in terms of history of philosophy and religious philosophy. Right? Maimonides does not think, unlike a lot of mystics, that reason can only get us so far. But beyond that, a mystical union is possible. Right, that's a common, if you abandon reason, you get beyond reason, there's something else. Maimonides thinks that reason can get you further than anything else, and it also can't get you very far. And it's actually in the contemplation of that staggering, incomprehensible chasm that religious experience occurs. And that's why many chapters of the Guide will end with sentences like, blessed is the one who dazzles us with his incomprehensibility, exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark. Right, so we'll talk more about this later on the substance, but I just wanted to share that there's some really subtle things, that there's something so austere about Maimonides. Right, it's actually not God's presence and closeness, but it's God's infinite distance, and even the inadequacy of the phrase infinite distance to describe God's distance, that is the linchpin and the center and the kind of beating heart, the inaccessible beating heart of religious life. Okay. Now, but we're going to step down the ladder a few rungs, just talking about the idea of God having a body and emotions as portrayed in the Bible. Okay, Andrew, if you would share the screen, and Jared, if you would read us through this fun passage here.
There are many things in existence that are clear and manifest. Primary intelligibles and things perceived by the senses. And in addition, the things that come near to these in respect to their clarity.
So if people are clear and manifest, 2 + 2 = 4, hot things can't be cold at the same time, the chair I'm sitting on is soft, right? The things of senses, and things like that. These are the clear and manifest. We know them through our basic ability, and we're incapable, Wittgenstein would say, of doubting them. We have certainty about them. Okay.
If people had been left as they naturally are, they would not have needed a proof of them. For instance, the existence of motion, the existence of a person's ability to act, the manifestations of generation and corruption, the natures of the things that are apparent to the senses, like the hotness of fire, the coldness of water, and many other things of this kind. Yet, since strange opinions have arisen due either to people who committed errors or to people who act with some end in view, so that professing such opinion, they ran counter to the nature of existence and denied a sensibly perceived thing or wished to suggest to the estimative faculty the existence of a non-existent thing, the people of science have had to resort to proving those manifest things and to disproving the existence of things that are only thought to exist. Thus, we find that Aristotle establishes the fact of motion as it had been denied and demonstrates the non-existence of atoms as their existence had been asserted. To this category belongs the denial of essential attributes to God, may God be exalted, for that denial is a primary intelligible. The reasons that led those who believe in the existence of attributes belonging to the Creator to this belief are akin to those that led those who believe in the doctrine of God's corporeality to that belief. For a person who believes in this doctrine was not led to it by intellectual speculation. They merely followed the external sense of the texts of the scriptures. This is also the case with regard to the attributes. For inasmuch as the books of the prophets and the revealed books existed, which predicated attributive qualifications of God, may God be exalted, these were taken in their literal sense, and God was believed to possess attributes.
Beautifully read. It's not an easy passage. So let me just break down what we covered here. So the first part, Maimonides says, there are things that we all know to be true. And then he says something here. He says, sometimes intellectual traditions take a wrong turn. And they come up with these ideas that are just untrue. And it's funny to see the existence of atoms, right? Like it's, we realize they are true. But they get it really wrong. And then someone like Aristotle has to come along and dig himself out of that hole that he never should have been in, do work he never should have had to do. Shouldn't have to prove that we can move. I know I can move because I just walked over and got a bottle of seltzer before this class started, and I walked back and sat in this chair. But some Zeno comes along with some fancy paradox about how a hare can never beat a tortoise because you have to get halfway there, but by that time the tortoise has moved on. And he proves the motion's impossible. And so then Aristotle has to come along and do something we all knew. We never had the problem as motion possible until Zeno made it. And then Aristotle has to fix it. That's something that can happen in intellectual tradition, Maimonides says. And interestingly, if you would scroll up just a little bit, Andrew, you'll see Maimonides is, and he's consistent. You'll see this in other places. He says, strange opinions have arisen due either to people who committed errors. Maybe Zeno was just confused. He really thought that for some reason, or to people who acted with some end in view, that they are actually, there's an instrumental reason that has led people to introduce this intellectual error. It could be they wanted to be famous. It could be like Dino's like, they're going to invite me to give a keynote at the next annual Philosophical Association if I make this outlandish argument, like clickbait, right? Or it could be he has like some regime he's trying to prop up. He doesn't like another philosopher trying to attack them, whatever it is. There's a non-innocent explanation for intellectual. Maimonides is very clear that happens in our tradition. So that's the account he's given. So everyone knew there is motion. Zeno came along and messed it up for maybe innocent mistake and maybe not. Said we don't believe in motion. Then Aristotle had to do this hard work and show something we all knew. Then if you scroll down, Maimonides says in the next, at the end of the first paragraph from 151 and the next one, which is from 153, this is what I, Maimonides, had to do with the idea that God doesn't have a body or emotion. He makes this claim, which is, I think, totally outrageous. No one ever thought that God had a body, except it seems like the Torah says that, because it says God's nostrils flare, and it says God, humanity was made in God's image and likeness. So I guess God looks like a person, just big, right? The tradition, the text of Torah and the prophets is like Zeno, read in its literal sense, which is not the right way to read it. We'll see next week and the week after. So I had to do a lot of work, just like Aristotle, to dig us out of this hole that we're only in because of the tradition and how it's been read. Now, right now, he's actually using the wrong way to read the Torah, but he gets that people do and why people do. So the picture here is quite striking, right? It's not just, we have problems nowadays that the Torah doesn't speak to, or even there are voices that are excluded from the Torah. This is the idea that, like, on a basic and important question, we all know something to be true, and I have to argue about it only because of the Torah. Now, I often feel this way, I didn't realize there was such a thing as egalitarian Judaism. I didn't really know there was such a thing as non-egalitarian Judaism. I feel this way about like questions around like gender equality. It's like, why are the only people I have to fight on as other Jews, right? Like, we wouldn't even be having this conversation if it weren't for certain Jewish texts. Now, there are a lot of other texts that also say it, but generally we feel like we've like moved past that. Does that make sense? That's that feeling that Maimonides is trying to capture. Naomi, can I ask you to read the next section here?
As for one who affirms an attribute of God without knowing a thing about it, except the mere term, it may be considered that the object to which he imagines the term applies is a non-existent notion, an invention that is false. For he has, as it were, applied this term to a notion lacking existence, as nothing in existence is like that notion. An example...
Well, just to be clear, he's saying a picture... One thing, you affirm an attribute of God without it knowing anything about it. That was probably the translation I use nowadays for Maimonidean God references. You're believing, you're running the danger, Maimonides says, when you say you believe in God, of believing in something that doesn't really exist, believing in a fiction, right? Those are the things. So let's keep going now. We'll see how this, the parable he gives.
An example is that of a man who has heard the term elephant and knows that it is an animal and demands to know its shape and true reality. Thereupon, one who is himself mistaken or who misleads others tells him that it is an animal possessing one leg and three wings, inhabiting the depths of the sea, having a transparent body and a broad face like that of a man in its form and shape, talking like a man and sometimes flying in the air, while at other times swimming like a fish. I will not say that this representation of the elephant differs from what the latter really is, nor that the man in question falls short in his apprehension of the elephant. But I shall say that the thing that he has imagined as having these attributes is merely an invention and is false, and that there is nothing in existence like that, but that it is a thing lacking existence to which a term signifying an existent thing has been applied. A thing like Enqua Mughrib or a centaur.
Which is a mythical Arab creature.
And other imaginary forms of this kind, to which a term, simple or compound, signifying some existent thing has been applied. In the present case,
okay.
The matter...
The
matter is similar and of the same kind. For God, may God's praise be magnified, is an existent whose existence has been demonstrated to be necessary. And as I shall demonstrate, from God's being, the necessarily existent, there necessarily follows God's absolute simplicity.
Yeah, that last sentence is a bear. Just because God is the necessary existent. What that means is the rest of us, everything else is contingently existent. The world could exist with me or without me. And we know that because the world existed before me. Right? I have a contingent existence. You could imagine a Jason Rubenstein didn't exist in the world without Jason Rubenstein. God's existence is not like that, right? God's existence is absolute and necessary. And therefore, even the word exists when applied to God is inaccurate, not just because of the linguistic thing that you can't describe any verbs of God, but because the nature, very nature of God's existence is different than the nature of the existence of everything else that exists. And that's the necessarily existent. And Maimonides believes that it follows from that that God is absolutely simple, in the sense that it's irreducible, doesn't have component parts or subdivisions. But that's what he's saying there in that sentence. So that is who or what God is. Okay.
As for thinking that this simple essence, whose existence, as has been said, is necessary, is endowed with attributes and with other notions accompanying it, the thing thus imagined cannot, as has been demonstrated, be existent in any respect. Accordingly, if we say that this essence, which for the sake of example shall be called deity, is an essence in which subsist many notions that are predicated of it, we apply the term to absolute non-existence.
Let's take this, let's work from the top to the bottom. So Maimonides, right, the picture is of a person who knows that there is such a thing called an elephant, and wants to understand what it is. And someone else, and again here Maimonides introduces these two options, either the other person is themselves mistaken or they're speaking tendentiously, maybe they jerk, maybe they're trying to pull a joke, maybe they, you know, whatever, want to deceive someone. They do want to deceive someone, but why? Creates a fantastical creature, a monster in the technical parlance. And now Maimonides says, okay, the person who's heard this account and believes it, it's not like they have a partial understanding of elephant or they, you know, are somewhat disfamiliar. It's like they don't know anything about elephants. And the thing that they believe exists is, you know, nonsense. It's absurd. And Maimonides says, the present case is similar and of the same kind, because God doesn't have attributes. And therefore, someone who thinks that, right, if you look at that, that this essence, right, which for the sake of simplicity shall be called the deity, is an essence in which subsist many notions that are predicated of. If you think, oh, there's God, and God is mighty, and God is powerful, God has arms, God, the type of character described in the Bible, right, the, you know, as Harold Bloom, Blessed Memory, said, you know, you say that God is God in the Bible is the second most interesting character in the literary canon after Hamlet. You take God as a character, and in that sense, God is saying that is a fictional character, is a monster. It doesn't apply, not in the sense of being horrifying, just in the kind of technical sense of like a griffin or a, you know, a centaur or a sphinx. There is no such entity. No, there is an entity that should be referred to as God. But to be clear, like, you as a reader of the Bible say, oh, this text says that there, you know, rides on the clouds and, you know, walks through the garden in the windy time of the day and whose, you know, feet make the, you know, Temple Mount in Jerusalem split. You know, that creature, if you imagine, or not creature, I'm sorry, because they're not created, that entity, right, doesn't exist. It belongs in the set of celestial beings that don't exist. If you could just turn off the screen share for a second, Andrew, because now I want to, we got to discuss this. You know, an interesting parallel, Borges has a short story, which is quite lovely, as all of his are, where he kind of goes through the celestial bestiary of antiquity, as he calls it. Right, all the centaurs and the griffins and the cherubs and the ophanim and the seraphim and all these different things that we have, you know, they're in the Talmud, they're in the Bible in certain places, they're certainly in apocryphal literature, and shows how kind of only the garden variety of angels survive from this into modernity. Right, there used to be a rich celestial bestiary of which angels were one member. And so it's a kind of an amazing piece in the history of ideas. And so what Maimonides is saying, more or less, is that the character of God as portrayed in the Bible is part of that fictional celestial bestiary. He doesn't address, you know, the kind of one of, there are many $64,000 questions that come here. One of them is, well, why did the Bible speak this way, right? He doesn't say either the Bible is error. He says it's speaking for some purpose, not a nefarious one, but it's got to speak on multiple literary levels. But there's something that is really uncompromising here about what Maimonides is saying about many people who would say they believe in God, if that makes sense, right? He's saying you believe in, you know, your imaginary friend in the sky. Like, I mean, it's just, he's because the entity that is, you know, worth being called deity is so austere and so minimal that it, you know, most of us wouldn't even necessarily call it God. Like a Big Bang or whatever was before the Big Bang is closer than a character with a will and memory and knowledge and love. Well, Maimonides would disagree with your president, I assume with you also, that it actually does matter a great deal how we define God. Right, okay, sure. Fine, very good question. What do we get? If you don't believe, right, I believe that atoms exist, for one, right? You know, I don't necessarily believe Maimonides as proofs of what must exist or what must not exist. So what are we getting out of him? And this is where I would use the distinction of, it's not so much the matter of Maimonidean thought, but the form. I'll give you an example of how I think about this passage. Let's say I tell you, I believe this, that I believe in justice, and I believe that the Bible teaches justice. And you say, okay, let's do it. And I say, and here's what justice looks like. Jews have a mitzvah to own chattel slaves from other nations. And young girls should be sold off as into arranged marriages. And there's a divine commandment of genocide against some people. And, you know, a woman who's found not to be a virgin on her wedding night should be stoned. That's justice, because that's what it says in the Bible. And Maimonides would say, well, there is such a thing as justice. And it is what the Bible's about. But if you just take the Bible's text and you read it literally to extract your picture of what that ultimate value is, you come up with something horrifying that no dignified person should be able to say with a straight face. So Maimonides just made that move theologically. I believe in God. I believe the Bible is about God. And if you just read off of the text of the Bible who is God, you will come up with something you should be embarrassed by. So then I just tried to share, what do we get out of that? I don't necessarily agree with my money's about God there, but I would take the same attitude towards justice and the Bible, if that makes sense. And various other concepts also. And I want to be clear here, there's Maimonides is not saying at this point, whoa, that says in the Bible, that might be true. He's like, that's ridiculous, idiotic. And I'm appalled that you don't realize that. Right? I don't care that the Bible says that. You're reading the Bible. Okay, that's what those words say if you read them literally, but no one, you're not supposed to read it literally. You know, are you embarrassed to say that with a straight face and polite company? Like, that level of intensity is what he allows you. So that's what I get out of reading Maimonides, right? What is Maimonides' relationship with the Talmud? Oh my gosh, let's do another eight session class. So right, you can imagine him roasting a lot of people, a lot of roasting. He actually a little bit later in life did apologize or regret, more accurately, some of the just the viciousness with which he attacked his opponents. Like something you would read from Sam Harris, right? So as you're saying, right, Sam Harris was kind of notable, you know, kind of contemporary atheist thinker, right? So there's just, I mean, there's something that is maybe freeing about this. Also, it's just something that is so, and it's uncompromising. It's unyielding in Maimonides. And I just want to pause and ask people to take for a moment to put it in the chat what it feels like to kind of have read this passage together and thought about it for the last few minutes in terms of what it means. Just if you would share kind of your experience of this, we'll get to one more passage, which is maybe even more intense in this vein. But let's stick with this one for now. What are you, you're like, I love it. Hey, I can't believe you said that. I'm crying. Or I feel so free.
Yeah, I feel like when you were laying out the claims, like, I believe in God. I believe the Bible talks about God. But if you say, like, that God is what the Bible says God is, then you're speaking ridiculously. And I thought your justice comparison was really helpful. Like, on the one hand, I was like, that feels like a really big leap to make.
What's the really big leap?
Between step two and three, I believe the Bible speaks about God, but I don't believe anything that the Bible says about God is literal. I don't actually believe the words of the Bible when it talks about God. I just believe that the God, Bible is talking about God in some way. I don't know. Or am I misunderstanding what you were saying?
No, you're right. I mean, what Maimonides says, and we'll spend time, some combination next time, but really in two sessions about this, is Maimonides says, and I think I used this in the mention of the first class, Maimonides, like the whole genre is like, if you, reading the Bible to learn about who God is as fact is like reading Romeo and Juliet to learn about Verona, or reading Hamlet to learn about Danish political history. It's just like, why are you doing that? It's like you've got the whole genre wrong. Now you can still love Romeo and Juliet and Hamlet, but you do it differently, right? So that's the move. It's a radical move, and you'll see Spinoza has no patience for it.
Right.
And I want to point out there's a huge loss, because you can't say, I read the Bible and therefore I know what to do. And therefore I know what's true. The way, you know, many of our Protestant friends talk. You can never do that again. And that's a big loss.
Yeah. So I think on the one, I was trying to say that, like, on the one hand, it does feel really audacious, and maybe Spinoza's complaint will like help me articulate that better. But on the other hand, it does feel like a lot of what I am doing with my Judaism in life. So it's like, I believe in the Bible, but I also like, I'm going to use these phrases when it conveniently agrees with me. And I'm going to like totally explain away these other phrases when it doesn't. And like that, you know, I have like a problem with that deep down, but anyway, it's something to grapple with.
Okay. Ezra, you've got your hand up also.
Yeah. It's like helpful in the sense that others have commented in his other works, like Rambam clearly sort of, I don't know, walks this back or whatnot, but like, you know, in other places, somehow like this God that doesn't have attributes, like dictated every word and letter of the Torah to Moshe.
Yeah, he spent a lot of time on this yesterday and basic, yeah. So good. So Izzy, if you go back and look at the eighth principle, you'll see actually it says, no one can know how it happened. It's a process allegorically called speech. But that's a whole other what happens if you take this seriously? Can you have a religious life? Is a really important question. Now, a couple of people, Sherry and someone else, have brought up, and I guess Saul, you know, well, okay, Maimonides has said quite clearly that the Bible is not his source of knowledge about who or what God is. So, well, what is that source of knowledge? Like, where does it come from then? It's a basic kind of epistemic question. So that is a great question. I mean, for Maimonides, it's a certain type and practice of philosophy, but it comes very much from the outside. And he's clear about that. We'll see that. And again, Spinoza doesn't really love that. I want to give one other parallel to this, which is like really fascinating, that happens in, I'm going to switch to gallery view so I can see you all. And it's a little bit more like the justice picture, but not quite. So there's a long tradition in Sharia law. I think it arises very, very early after Muhammad's conquest, like 8th, 9th century in the caliphate, that the law of the Quran is unworkable as like practical law. And so you get these kind of two layers of this ideal law of the Quran and then the laws of the kings. There is a similar position is actually, and this is shocking, it's probably Maimonides' position, but it's certainly the position of Rabbi Nissim of Gerona, and is the mainstream Jewish political position in the Jewish tradition until the 1950s. If you want to read the book about how this stopping is, Alex Kay's The Invention of Jewish Theocracy, which is really about the Israeli chief rabbinate in the 40s through 70s. But the idea, which is a kind of breathtaking idea, is that the dream of halakha, of Jewish law, is not to become a blueprint for society. Or in, you know, kind of technical Maimonidean language, the Jewish sovereign, the melech, mandate is not to impose halakha, but to create yishuv hamedina, an orderly society. And therefore, halakha says things like, a court can't execute two people in the same day, and a court requires two eyewitnesses who warn the perpetrator right before they committed crime. And the perpetrator acknowledged warning and didn't just nod, and they didn't just say, yes, I know, and they didn't just say, yes, I know, I understand. They said, yes, I know, I understand, and I'm committing this crime, understanding that about this punishment. And then they committed the crime within about 3.5 seconds, because if it was more than 3.5 seconds from when they gave that verbal acknowledgement to committing the crime, maybe they changed their mind, and you don't know. And if and only if you have all of those things can you give someone the death penalty. And Rabbi Nissim of Gerona says, this is totally unworkable. And this is actually not even what the Torah meant for society to look like. This is how rabbis are supposed to adjudicate cases, as an exercise in pure justice. We might think of it something like a moral reasoning seminar, a philosophy class with a Michael Sandel or a Shelley Kagan. And then there's this separate institution of the courts, the king's courts, that are supposed to, they take one witness, they don't require a warning, they can punish people even for crimes that maybe weren't written explicitly because they need to lishbor yad harasha'im, to defeat the power of the wicked, and litakein olam, actually, to say, to establish a world that's inhabitable. So this is the mainstream political position. It gets resurrected, actually, in the 1930s when Rav Herzog, who at that point was the Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Israel, writes a letter to his teacher, Rabbi Chaim Ozer Grodzinski, the great rabbi of Vilna between the wars, and says, I want your help thinking about a Jewish constitution for a Jewish state, because, for example, it says you can't appoint non-Jews to positions of sovereignty. And we'll need to have Arabs and Christians, you know, Christians and Muslims in positions, and dog catchers and judges. What are we going to do? And Rabbi Gazin says, I don't see what the problem is. Rabbeinu Nissim has already said that a Jewish polity isn't supposed to run according to halakha. Your laws of a state of Israel should really just like the British ones, the Ottoman ones. There's no special Jewish picture of a society. There's no special Jewish engineering for how your synagogue is. Maybe there's special Jewish architecture. You don't get special Jewish engineering rules about how walls. You don't get, you know, there's how people do this. And so what happens is becomes a kind of Haredi anti-Zionism, right? There's no such thing as a Jewish state. Jews don't speak on that scale. You know, the best you'll do is you'll run the government, but that has no religious significance. This is a shocking thing to say. David Hartman was the opposite of this, right? That there's the simcha, you know, the joy of creating a society of justice. But the reason I'm sharing this for you is that on this Rabbeinu Nissim and Achiezer position, well, two things happen. One is, since Rabbeinu Nissim said that, all these Achronim, great, you know, posting will say, you know, oh yeah, and here are examples of the Torah's laws that are totally unworkable. you know, a thief who's caught just has to pay back double restitution. So if you're caught less than one third of the time, you can make a great living as a thief. There's no prison, there's no lashes, there's no public anything, you'll do it. Right? So what you see is you get all these achronim saying, oh yeah, and here are the parts of the Torah that are bad. Policy, right? And they say, well, I'm just commenting on Rabbeinu Nissim. But I mean, the thing which is stark, you know, it's very freeing to say this in a lot of ways. The indigenous Jewish political theory is not a theocracy. It's an amazing thing to look at. On the other hand, when you're reading the Torah now, you're not actually deriving a blueprint of how the world should look. You're doing a kind of an exercise in a certain type of moral reasoning, a certain type of divine covenantal moral reasoning. But it's not actually like you should take Bava Kamma and then turn that into civil law. You should take Sanhedrin and make it civil procedure. Does that make sense? Which is a huge loss, perhaps, in what you're doing, right? And that's a similar loss to Maimonides. You can't just read off this text and say, now I know what ought to be. It's a different type of activity you're engaged in. Just like I don't think you would say, like, well, I had a discussion as a sophomore about whether affirmative action is just, and now we should write policy based on that, you know, in a philosophy class. There's a lot of other things you got to take into account also. I want to look at this last passage here because it's going to become really important for showing just how pitched this conflict is. So, Phyllis, can I ask you to read this last one? And Andrew, if you could share the screen again. This is a bit earlier, but it's, as you'll see, on a similar theme, we're not too far away in the guide. So go for it. And just so you know, the character here is Alexander of Aphrodisias, who is one of the main commentators on Aristotle. And Maimonides recommends his commentaries as some of the best of them. So he's a kind of a, you know, at the very top of the second tier of philosophers. And he actually is quoted three or four times.
Alexander of Aphrodisias says that there are three causes of disagreement about things. One of them is love of domination and love of strife, both of which turn man aside from the apprehension of truth as it is. The second cause is the subtlety and the obscurity of the object of apprehension in itself and the difficulty of apprehending it. And the third cause is the ignorance of him who apprehends and his inability to grasp things that it is possible to apprehend.
Okay, so I just want to pause here. So there's three, Alexander, so there's a question someone posted in the chat, or a point maybe better. You know, well, where is the something we could all agree to? Turns out, you know, we're all very poor at agreeing about most things, except, you know, some Washington Post ran a story, 90% of Americans agree the country's on the wrong track. One thing we can all agree on, basically, is things are bad, get worse. Other than that, we can't really agree on things. So why? Why is it? Interesting question. So reasons two and three here from Alexander are similar. First is like, it's sometimes just really hard. The world is complicated. You know, proofs take a lot of steps, et cetera. It's just the truth is intrinsically difficult. The other version of it is, okay, the individual who's doing the thinking may not be particularly good at this. They may not have the background. They may not have the concepts. They may not have the facility, et cetera. You know, so these are different sides of the same thing. The first one, love of domination and strength. People like, and I don't think here what he primarily means is like people want to advance theories, new theories to like get themselves to the top of their academic field. He means people turn man aside from the apprehension of truth as it is, right? Our reasoning is often motivated. We like ideas that make us feel good, right? And therefore, and that feel, make us feel okay and justified and in our position, and that we shouldn't be racked by guilt. Or maybe we like being racked by guilt and we look for ideas that make us feel racked by guilt, right? And talk to your therapist about that. And, but that's the basic idea, right? That there's an idea that thinking is often self-serving. And that's the main, the first reason. So far, so good. Okay, so I'm going to take it away with the next paragraph now.
This is what Alexander mentioned. However, in our times, there is a fourth cause that he did not mention because it did not exist among them. It is habit and upbringing. For man has...
No, I just want to point out that's absurd because habit and upbringing did exist in the time of Alexander of Aphrodisias. Right? So just, there's something weird is going on. We'll see what it is, but like, just note that. Like, wait a second. Maimonides must mean either he's being deeply ironic or he has a very specific picture of habit and upbringing, which didn't exist back then. Okay, let's see.
For man has in his nature a love of and an inclination for that to which he is habituated. Thus you can see that the people of the desert, notwithstanding the disorderliness of their life, the lack of pleasures, and the scarcity of food, dislike the towns, do not hanker after their pleasures, and prefer the bad circumstances to which they are accustomed to good ones to which they are not accustomed. Their souls accordingly would find no repose in living in palaces, in wearing silk clothes, and the enjoyment of baths, ointments, and perfumes.
Great. Now, I just want to pause. This is a very interesting image. So Maimonides is describing the way that we have a kind of conservative bias in our thinking. And sure, I just mean to bias towards, you know, what we're familiar with. And he gives this example on an aesthetic level. And what's so striking here, and here you can feel a second note of irony, right? On the one hand, he's saying that they're, you know, the people of the desert, of disorderly life, seems bad, right? It seems like they are, Maimonides thinks they are kind of, this is a source of error, right? That's the category. When people have wrong thoughts, that's the topic from Alexander of Aphrodisias. And here seems to be an example. The people of the desert have wrong thoughts about which is better, towns or deserts, right? I mean, that's the structure, and here's why. But then look how he describes them at the end. They don't want to live in palaces, wear silk clothes, and enjoy baths, ointments, and perfumes. But remember exactly what we saw last week. The people who think that the redeemed human life is living in palaces, wearing silk clothes, and enjoying baths, ointments, and perfumes are a huge part of the problem. They're not right. They're fundamentally missing what it means to be a human being. And so here's a second note of really interesting irony. This is like almost, you can see Maimonides, if you want to be postmodern about it, deconstructing his argument. Right? He's saying this is a source of a picture of people who have an error because of their fondness of their upbringing, but who are in fact right. It's really interesting to say something, you know, what we've seen and also in the guy. So really need to hold that one also, just like the first one about the newness of custom numbering. So, but now he's going to bring down the hammer.
In a similar way, man has love for and the wish to defend opinions to which he is habituated and in which he has been brought up and has a feeling of repulsion for opinions other than those. For this reason, also man is blind to the apprehension of the true realities and inclines toward the things to which he is habituated. This happened to the multitude with regard to the belief in his corporeality and many other divine subjects, as we shall make clear. All this is due to people being habituated to and brought up on texts that is an established usage to think highly of and to regard as true, and whose external meaning is indicative of the corporeality of God and of other imaginings with no truth in them.
Beautifully read. Thank you, Phyllis. So the picture here is that this upbringing that Maimonides is describing is a very specific one, which is an upbringing in the Torah. And not just that we read the Torah, but that we revere the Torah. And part of how we revere the Torah is we regard it as true. And Maimonides is saying this is a deep source of error. Similar to before, this is similar to the passage in Aristotle. The first passage you saw about Aristotle had to, you know, show that motion exists, and Maimonides has to show that no body exists. But Maimonides here is not just describing on the plane of ideas, but on the plane of popular belief. He's saying part of the reason the Jews, maybe more than his Muslim neighbors, are resistant to the idea of divine incorporeality is because the Jews have the Torah and were raised on it and were taught to respect it. And they believe that these ideas that Maimonides is describing are antithetical to this Torah and will undermine their religious lives. And so here, I just want to be clear, it hurts to say these words, but Maimonides is saying them because he believed they were true. Right? Maimonides believes that the practice of studying Torah reverentially as it's done by Jews of his day is destroying their souls. Right? Those are hard words. Right? I mean, he also believes that there's a lot of it, and done right, it's great. But just to be really clear, he believes that like in his project to improve and emancipate Jewish people and help them live what the way that they are reading Torah is a stumbling block for them and before him.
I mean, and here, you know, we could flip, if you just open up, I just put it on my bookshelf, we moved in here, you know, Susanna Heschel's on being a Jewish feminist. And you could find no shortages of essays from the early 70s that say the same thing about patriarchy in Judaism. Our work to create a feminist Judaism is impeded by the way that, how we treat the Torah in our traditions. Not just neutral, it doesn't speak as necessary, it's like our regard for it and our practice of reading it literally and directly, which is a tradition we have, is making us worse, not better right now. And what I want to be clear, this is Maimonides, is, you know, just from a different perspective. It's not just that he thinks that there's a source of truth outside of the Torah. Here you see he also thinks that there's a source of value outside of the Torah, which is a little bit different. And according to that value, the reverential study of the Torah is not an unalloyed good. Andrew, if you could just turn the screen off for a second. The most apt thing, I thought in some ways there's a way of reading all of Maimonides, all the guide as a commentary on this little tiny piece of Talmud from Rava. You know, Rava says, for one who merits, the Torah is an elixir of life, sama chayim. And for someone who doesn't merit, the Torah is an elixir of death, sama mavet. In the picture, sometimes reading the Torah makes you worse. Studying the Torah, and sometimes it makes you better. Like, I mean, and what does it mean to merit? How do we know, et cetera, is a hard question. Right, and I've heard that Marissa, right, that there is a, this is someone speaking from an urban context. So I just wanted to share, like, this is, you know, I hope it hurts to read this in a different way, perhaps, than the perplexity. This is a little bit of text. The Torah is a little bit of text. These are the kinds of passages that lead people to classify Maimonides as a heretic. I mean, you can understand, but those people are coming from something, right? I mean, it's, you know, on some level, you have to say, well, Maimonides is a heretic. Maybe we should all agree on that. We can disagree on whether it's a good or bad thing. But it's hard after this to say that there's not something deeply heretical. I don't know if people know this. The etymology of the word heresis in Greek is choice. When you choose this topped out, and this is the basis, find the great, really lovely small book by Peter Berger, the sociologist of religion, The Heretical Imperative, about what happens to religion when the way that Berger actually defines modernity, it's such a beautiful definition, is you can almost describe a continuum of modernity by how much of someone's life they have agency over. You heard this in the 70s, right? Like, do you choose what town you live in? Do you choose your profession? Do you choose who you marry? He says, we're just starting to think about, do you choose whether you have a profession or we are children? He says, we're just starting to talk about, do you choose the sex of the person you live with? Like, that's new to him. I mean, you can imagine, but you can take it further. Like, do you choose what genitals you have? Right? Like that. Now, that doesn't describe, you know, there's not necessarily a value judgment to that, right? The more choice is better. But what Berger is trying to figure out is, well, what does it mean? Like, the choice is the nature of modern existence in a way that it wasn't before. And therefore, that inevitably, it immediately changes what religion is, because it now occurs and it's chosen in a way that it wasn't before, just like all these other things change because they're chosen. So that is the heretical moment. Maimonides is kind of choosing, in a certain sense, to stand outside. Spinoza feels betrayed by Maimonides because he thinks Maimonides was the first person to really realize and say that the Torah is not a very good book. But then he didn't do what Spinoza wanted him to do, which is just to put it down and stop reading it. Right? Maimonides came back to it and read it his whole life and spent a year of his life writing a copy of it, right? And wrote the guide understanding it. And that's the thing which is truly, you know, remarkable. And we're going to spend our time thinking about how and why does he do that? Because the door of Spinoza is always open at this point. And, you know, probably 99% of people, the Sam Harrises of the world, who think and feel the things like we read, would take that door without a second thought, take the red pill. But Maimonides didn't. And that's how I love him.